Hi, this is Russ Volkman, publisher and editor of Integral Leadership Review. You're probably tired of hearing me say that by now after this almost a month of conference. It's been quite extraordinary. We're down to the day before the last day, the day before the last day. And it's going to be a really exciting day. We've got presentations today that just really make the whole conference worth it, just in and of themselves. Today we have Peter Mary. Peter Mary is a Brit. He's from the UK, who now lives in the Netherlands with his family. And I make the assumption that he moved to the Netherlands for love. I don't know that, but maybe he can tell us if that's the case.
Correct.
But Peter Mary is... correct. Okay, good. Peter is a moving force in the Spiral Dynamics Integral Movement in the Netherlands on a number of different levels. He has worked very closely with Don Beck, is one of the key founders of the Center for Human Emergence in the Netherlands. Together with Don Beck, they worked on a project dealing with some of the challenges that have come from Muslim immigration into the Netherlands and some of the violence that has occurred there. In addition to that, he is the author of a book that Integral Publishers published, one of our early books. And Peter, I promise you, for the next one, we know how to do it a lot better this time. and it's called Evolutionary Leadership. And it's a fascinating book because it's not only dealing with a lot of the really valuable models and applications in integral leadership and organizational transformation and the like. These models are also in color, which makes them really very spirally and easy to follow. And it's based not just on work such as I described with Don, but also based on Peter's work as a consultant in corporations like IBM in the Netherlands and with the Dutch government and others. So in addition to that, Peter has initiated something called Wisdom University, and I'm personally curious to learn more about what that's going to evolve towards, so maybe we'll hear a little bit about that today. And then finally, he has assembled around him an extraordinary group of people, Ellen Townsend, who you'll be hearing from tomorrow about the waking in the workplace, another Brit who moved to the Netherlands, and Anouk Brock, who was on a call just a couple of days ago, Elaine Vols, who's the Dutch Bureau Chief for Integral Leadership Review, and a host of others who are doing really exceptional work. And I'm really looking forward to hearing more about all that. Before I turn it over to Peter, I just want you to know that he's going to present, and then you can ask questions after the presentation. I'd like you to hold your questions. And you can do that by pressing 1 on the keypad of your phone or your Skypad. We will then go into question-answer periods. So as he's talking, I highly, highly encourage you to take a note or two about any questions that come up for you, and I'm looking forward to hearing from you. And if I don't hear from you, I'll call on some of you, and you know that. So that's what we'll do after he is through with his initial presentation. And then we will have some time to go into breakout rooms, and Peter has indicated that he would like to be able to stay with us and hear how things go with the breakout rooms and be available for your comments and questions when you're ready after those breakout sessions have occurred. So, Peter, without further ado, I hope I did you justice, and I'm really looking forward to hearing what you have to say.
Thank you, Russ, and thanks for the honor of the invitation as well. It seems like an amazing initiative you guys have got together here. So great to see this happening, and kind of very cool to know that there's people all across the world tuned in right now. And what I'd actually like to do before I start my story is just together set the field for this call. And to do that, I just invite us all to come into our inner space that most of us who are integral practitioners will have our own way of doing, just to breathe and ground ourselves, feel our connection to the earth, feel our connection to the heavens, allow our chattering mind to quieten down a bit. And then where heaven meets earth in our heart, for that to go out horizontally across the planet, connecting up all the people who are in this call right now and all the people who may access this call in the future from a recording. Because in this space, we go beyond linear time. So all the people who somehow connect to this call at any point in time are present with us now, and remind ourselves that we are the earth listening to herself, and we are the earth speaking to herself right now. We're the divine listening to ourselves right now and speaking to ourselves. We can hold that space. We'll see what happens. There we go. There we go. That's pretty cool, isn't it? There we go. Good. Good. So Russ asked me before I kind of started on my stuff to say a little bit about the history of how I got into integral work. I'm going to keep it pretty short because I've got a story I want to share. But I was really, I mean, my background's really as a kind of theatre practitioner, environmental social justice activist in the UK. I was very much involved in green politics, play folk music, play rugby, that kind of world. And I was on the streets digging holes in motorways and planting trees and all those kind of fun things that you get up to. And at some point I started to get a little disillusioned with that movement. I was sensing essentially the shadow side of green and the kind of talk of peace, love and justice and the minimal practice of it within one's own community and the polarization and demonization of the rest of the world who didn't believe in the same things that you were believing in. And it happened to be at that point that I moved to the Netherlands, and I still quite remember how, but I picked up Ken's theory of everything, which kind of completely transformed my worldview. And embedded in that was spiral dynamics, as a lot of you will know. And suddenly all sorts of pieces fell into place, and I was kind of spiral dynamics. Okay, where can I learn more about this? I ended up doing spiral dynamics 1, 2, and 3 in rapid succession with Domberg in Germany. And I'm somebody who, if I come across an idea or a concept, I want to try applying it straight away. So I was kind of starting to tell others about it and applying it in many different contexts. And of course, when you come across Ken's work and you really sense the implications of the four quadrants at that point, probably about 11, 12 years ago now, you realize the significance of the inner work, and that I can try to change as much as I want in the world outside, but until I do my inner work, I'm purely projecting my own mess into the outside world and making it worse. So from that point on, I developed a fairly disciplined spiritual practice, classic kind of meditation form, and then later on a number of different more kind of body energetic forms, which I won't go into in detail now unless people are interested later. And having spent most of my time in the NGO kind of world, I realized that the corporate sector needed to be part of the solution, so I threw myself into corporate consulting for a few years, had some good successes there, applying an integral approach, worked with kind of cultural change processes in government ministries using Theory U with Spiral and Integral informing us in that work, and started to get into multi-stakeholder collaboration, essentially, which has been the work the last few years. Well, growing in the background has been an increasing interest in energetics, in the space in between things, both earth energetics and the subtle energies of whole systems, and I'm going to be speaking a bit about that later. So that's kind of a little bit of the story of how I got into this. I owe a great debt of gratitude to Dr. Don Beck for his trust in me, for his sharing of all the wisdom he's brought into the world, and really for his groundedness in the world. That's what's kind of stuck me. He's an activist at heart, and that's what the theory kind of makes sense to me, because I'm always asking myself, how can we make the most positive impact possible in the world? And so integral theory and spiral dynamics for me are important, and now the energy work, because they help us to contribute to ultimately a healthier world. So what I want to spend a bit of time on is, I first want to talk a bit about context, the context that we're in right now, and then talk a little bit about how I'm seeing the dynamics of consciousness now and the work that is being required of us. So context, it's very important to start with context. One of the key qualities that attracts me to the spiral dynamics way of looking at the world is this interaction between life conditions and coping mechanisms, which are the value systems. They co-arise. It's a four quadrant co-arising. So we can't talk about consciousness development outside of the context of our life condition. So we need to ask ourselves right now, what is the context that we are in and what is it asking of us? An integral approach is about fit between our value systems and coping mechanisms and the needs of the world. It's not about continual transcendence up into the wild, subtle realms of third, fourth, fifth, seventh tier, however many people want to layer onto it. So the question is, what is our context demanding of us now? And I know very few people in the world who are really looking the context in the eye, looking our life conditions in the eye at the moment. And the reason we need to do that is because it's no good just cognitively understanding what's happening in the world. For our body, mind, heart system to respond to what's happening, we need to let it in fully. We actually have to sit with the reality of what's happening in the world and feel it in every sinew of our body, allow it to penetrate into ourselves, however painful it might be. Because it's only when we really let it in that as an organism, as a living being, our system will respond in a way that's adequate. So we have to sit with the context. And the context at the moment is not pretty. It's not pretty. I think we're in for turbulence, the like of which we can't really imagine. I mean, we're beginning to see the early phases of it, and those of you in the US have probably had, you know, more of it than a lot of us recently. But this is the tip of the iceberg. The extreme weather conditions we're going to face are going to accelerate. The economy is not going to recover. We're going to get increasing stress. The extreme weather conditions are going to put pressure on social tensions as people who can't grow their own food anymore are going to move, and others are going to protect themselves from those movements. There's going to be increasing inter-ethnic tension. As the stress builds up ecologically, we're likely to see far more pandemic diseases spread and mutate, challenging our health system that's tried to control the impact rather than get to the source of illness. And all of these things are going to happen at the same time. So when we have a front page which is about wildfires somewhere, the rest hasn't gone away. It's all there and it's all mounting and they're all locked into increasing feedback loops. So we're in for turbulence, the like of which it's very hard for us to imagine. There's likely to be large amounts of suffering in the world, large amounts of conflict. And we really need to look it in the eye, you know, find the sources of information that aren't scared to tell the truth of what's happening. And even if it's just a few minutes a day, sit with some stark fact about what's happening. It's only when we do that that we give ourselves the chance, our systems the chance to respond adequately. Now, of course, what's also going on as systems collapse is new systems are emerging, and we're seeing those spring up cell-like across the planet. If we only focus on that, then we lose our groundedness in the reality of what's happening and don't give ourselves the chance to respond. So it's very important that we connect to context. And context right now is increasingly complex, increasingly rapid in terms of time acceleration. Now, Munich Re said recently that they could no longer calculate risk on extreme weather events because they were too unpredictable. So their models wouldn't work. So they can't insure people, companies anymore against extreme weather events. The whole system is cracking and falling apart. This is a moment of non-linear transition, of emergence, of breakdown and breakthrough. But very important that we root ourselves in context, that we allow ourselves to breathe it in a form of Tong Len practice, like where we let the pain in and we hold it there and we see how does our body respond as we hold today's fact of the famine, let's say, in East Africa of 750,000 people without enough food threatened by starvation. How do we hold facts like that in our hearts and allow our system to respond and take it in? So very, very important context that we allow ourselves to connect to life conditions, look them in the eye and hold them there. Not to generate fear, but to practice what somebody beautifully wrote called the discipline of disillusion, the discipline of disillusion. So take away the illusions, you know, of everything's going to be okay. And it's very hard. You know, we just have to hold this kind of conflict of knowing what's happening, seeing the big patterns in the world, seeing the turbulence coming, and yet the kind of seeming, the kind of everyday life that goes on. Well, we've got to change the nappies, you know, we've got to, the kids got to go to school, food's got to be bought, stuff has got to happen. Now, all of that's going on, and there's this turbulence on its way. And we don't have to resolve that, but just holding those two is key. So look it in the eye. So as I sit with that context and have sat with it for many years in my life, continually asking myself, how could I be of greater service at this time, given who I am and the place which I am? We've been working, as I said, for a while on kind of multi-stakeholder collaboration, what we've been calling mesh working, a term which I first heard when I did the training with Dr. Dombeck all those years ago, and which stayed with me, which was how we create the collaboration between and the connections between the different parties with their different value systems that's needed to match the complexity of the challenge that we're facing. So it's a systemic law that the complexity of a challenge needs to be met by the requisite diversity. And the challenges today are big and complex, and the requisite diversity means that parties are going to have to collaborate together in ways that they've not had to before. So we've been developing processes and approaches and frameworks for how we enable these different players to work together. Kind of green, yellow, rooted really in a green, yellow context. And not long ago, maybe last year, we began, a number of us in that work began to get a sense that somehow there was something not quite right about the way we were going about it. One, it requires a huge amount of effort and energy. The complexity is so huge when you've got 20 different organizations you're trying to facilitate to make a contribution, for example, to Millennium Development Goal 5 on maternal and newborn health, that you can't really engineer that complexity. You know, we're not going to be able to systems think our way through this challenge right now. In fact, we're reaching, in my experience and in our experience, the limits of the capacity of the cognitive mind to think, plan, engineer its way out of this crisis. We can't rely solely on those capacities anymore. And so we had a sense that there was, and I really believe in this thing, like we're looking for the simplicity, the other side of complexity. And we were seeming to be trying to match complexity with complexity. So, but where was the simplicity, the other side of it? And as we inquired into that, one day I picked up my dog-eared copy of Spiral Dynamics and turned to the yellow turquoise pages, the transition from yellow to turquoise, and read again the turquoise chapters, if I'd actually never read it before. And I was, so maybe this is what's happening, where it was talking about simplicity, grace, energy flows, all of these kind of things that have come out of our conversations about what we were feeling we needed or missed. So we embarked in the CHE here on a turquoise research project, the results, the first phases of which we're about to publish. And I started realizing that we really needed to get a sense of what this value system was about. We really needed to inquire into it, stretch ourselves to try to get a feel of what it really is, not just what the nice words say, but an embodied experience of it is. And as I delved into that, I realized something quite interesting, which connected to work which I had been doing with Dylan Newcombe, who some of you may know, whose work was originally called The 16 Ways and now called Uzazu. And he's many things, but he's originally a dancer, also a great philosopher and spiritual practitioner and all sorts of things. But what he did is he experimented with a number of dancers. He wanted to see how sound matched movement and had them do loads and loads of workshops and came up with 8 sounds that matched 8 movements. And they were kind of core energy dynamics. And then someone pointed into the I Ching, and he suddenly saw that these energy dynamics, which can be expressed through sound and movement, matched the I Ching like perfectly. And then being integrally informed, he suddenly had a sense that there was a relationship between these 8 energy dynamics and the spiral. So that's when he called me, and we spent good time really with these dancers, with these people in their bodies, exploring what are the physical energy dynamics of this, of the spiral. And one of the things that's very interesting is that when you go from beige to up to blue, there's a set of movements. And then what happens is it mirrors itself. So you then kind of go orange up to turquoise, and the movements from in orange, for example, are the same as blue. They express themselves in a slightly different way, but they're the same as blue. And so it mirrors up. So the interesting thing is that turquoise mirrors beige when you look at it in this way. When you choose to look at the spiral through an octave lens, which is a choice. Now, Gray's talking about a series of six. You can choose to look at it through different lenses. When you look at it as an octave lens, there's a system of eight up to turquoise. You see this dynamic where the spiral, where you see kind of turquoise linked to beige, yellow linked to purple, red linked to green, and an orange linked to blue. So you're almost expanding circles out from the center of the spiral. And these were, it's not just a theory, but this is what the dancers felt in their bodies. And the key thing is that the beige turquoise movement sounds are the fundamental yin yang dynamic. So like they're the two level of the I Ching. If you've got like oneness and then I Ching and yin yang, and then it kind of breaks down into four and then into eight. It goes to it starts with those fundamental yin yang dynamics. They're the same. And I was kind of, for something in this. And then yellow resonates with purple. Same movements. There's something in how the transcendent resonates with the immanent, resonates with the earlier systems. And this really helped me see some things more clearly, because I had this strong sense that for all this transcendence work that we see in spiritual development world, and a lot in the integral movement as well, it's all this talk of evolutionaries, it's all kind of up and beyond, kind of Superman style, up into the heavens. Fundamentally, we're missing a key point here, which is our connection to our precognitive unity, which is beige and purple, essentially. And beige is like the body, the physical, it's the earth, and the purple, as the mind begins to come into body. It's really the precognitive, the pre-ego, the pre-self, before we distinguished ourselves out. And as I sensed into that, I had an intuition to pick up from Eden again, Ken's work. If you've not read Up From Eden by, you know, Ken Wilber's Up From Eden, I highly, highly recommend it. A beautiful description of our journey, collective journey over time. And he describes how we move from the typhon phase, which is like the kind of snake eating its tail, which is the kind of beige purple, into the solar ego, into red, as it were. And how that step was, rather than being a healthy transcend and include, was actually a transcend and repress in what's now the industrialized world. So as we separated out, instead of separating out and then holding the connectedness, holding the consciousness and awareness of the fact that we are the earth, that fundamentally we are interconnected, and there is a basic trust in reality that comes with that fundamental knowing. We weren't able to hold that connectedness, and we disconnected from those earlier systems. And what that meant, that's the tragedy, really, of our development. That's the pain in the title of my talk. Because what has happened is that red, then, and the rest of the spiral that unfolds above that has no roots, is not rooted, is not grounded, is not resting in the fundamental body that we are. And so red goes Wild West cowboy. And so what happens when blue emerges in response to red? It gets extra super controlling, because red's gone wild, and blue needs to clamp down to kind of keep some sense of healthy civilization so we can live and work together. And then orange, as red shifts to orange under the influence of that control system in blue, kind of goes, well, hey, out of here, man, radical freedom is what we want. So orange gets extreme freedom, in the process rapes the planet, which we would never have been able to do if we'd held that deep interconnectedness. And then green swings out to the other extreme and becomes this kind of, oh, but please, no, let's kind of get into the relatedness. And rather than green being its natural, powerful self, being able to feel into all forms of life, it kind of becomes what we know when green steps into its unhealthy expression. So what we've got is a spiral out of balance, out of kilt. And until we're able to, like, hold the non-rational systems, and by that I mean the pre-rational beige purple and the yellow turquoise, just imagine a kind of almost like osteopathy of the spiral, where you kind of stretch down from beige purple, stretch up from yellow turquoise, and the other systems can click into place, the spine can click into place. I think that's the essence of the problem that we have on our hands. It's like what happened. It's like the mind forgot that it was needed a body to be able to exist. And if we think of humanity as the mind of the planet, it's like we forgot that we exist thanks to the earth that gave birth to us. We are made of the stuff of the earth, of the stuff of stars in our body, quite literally. And it's like we forgot that. It's like the mind kind of went, hey, cool, this is a cool existence. Why don't I just mine the liver? And I'll dig out the heart, you know. And then suddenly the kind of body goes, well, wait a minute, buddy, you know, if you're going to do that, then we're in trouble. We're going to get a little sick. So our body is sick because we forgot that it's who we are, basically. It's nuts. It's completely nuts, but that's what we forgot. And Ken has this beautiful quote set up from Eden, which is kind of really alive for me at the moment, which is, when the great mother is repressed, the great goddess is concealed. When the great mother is repressed, the great goddess is concealed. And the great mother is that precognitive purple that he's pointing to, that deep, dark feminine that holds everything, holds it all. And then the great goddess that is hidden from us, unless we can heal that split, is where he's pointing to the post-cognitive unity up at Turquoise. So my sense of the real work that we have to do is to access the parts of our being beyond or outside of the rational. Because the rational, the mind in its nature, distinguishes, separates in a very useful, functional way, but only if it's embedded, in a basic sense of unity. So what we're going to have to do in all of us in our own way is go back and heal that split, heal the split that happened when we moved from purple to red, from the solar ego. And that's a split in ourselves, in our own journey, and that's a split in our collective, in the industrialized world, at least. There's a collective pathology, a massive collective shadow that over history has led to the murder of millions of people, mainly women, who practiced earth-based spirituality or who said you could have a direct connection to the divine. It doesn't have to be mediated by a priest. Those people, there's this huge shadow that really we often don't speak about, but we need to bring it to the fore. We need to look it in the eye and we need to address it, because until we've addressed that pain, until we are really feeling held again, we're not going to get access, proper embodied access to the world of energetics that we really need to be able to engage the challenges we're facing today. It's my belief that it's from the place of unity and interconnectedness that we're really going to be able to address these problems. And that is not a mental interconnectedness, not a systems map of the system. No, it's a completely different capacity, a completely different quality that we need to develop. And rightly, it goes both ways. It's not like first we heal the split, then we get access to the other. They emerge together, because as Ken also says beautifully, it's from when we get to the transpersonal. That's when we're able to release the energies again of the pre-personal, of the beige purple. And at the same time, until we've re-embedded that, realigned the spine of the spiral, we won't get access, full embodied access. Right? We can go way up to those subtle realms and get all sorts of trips. But guys, if we can't hold those energies in our bodies, they're no use to the earth or humanity at this time. So we need to bring them into the bodies. We need to reconnect to our bodies, bring those energies in. And from that place, we can show up with the grace and the power that's really going to make a difference at this time. So that's my sense of the essence of the work. And, you know, if I think back to where I experienced that work, let's say the kind of healing of the pain, healing of the split work, early on, it was really the work which was then called Deep Ecology and is now called the work that reconnects, that Joanna Macy and John Seed in particular have worked on, where you really get this experiential reminder of the fact that we are the earth. You know, we don't save the earth, well, that's kind of save ourselves. You know, there is, it's like anybody looking from outer space would go, you know, well, you are the earth, right? So there's that level of work out there. And Joanna's book is beautifully titled Coming Back to Life, because that's what it's about, coming back to life, alive, the pulsing wildness of nature, the wind as it blows, the wildness of Celtic folk music surging through your veins, or the artist creativity, whatever it is. We need to come back to life. get out of our heads, get into our bodies again, and come back to life, back to the essence of life, understand life, engage life, play life, speak the language of life, speak the language of nature again. That's what we need to learn to do. And that power that that releases when it's held in this basic trust and this fundamental realization of the absolute context, where ultimately everything's already perfect. We know everything's already perfect. There's absolutely nothing to do in that space. Everything's perfect. And we incarnated into a body on the earth at this time to play the game and do the work. And when we hold both of those, then the work is a joy, because ultimately it's not driven by fear. Fundamentally, we know we have a basic trust, and we know that all is very well, just as it is. So there's that piece. And then as I've been exploring the kind of turquoise, the energetic realms, there's some really great stuff out there, you know, people, which we need to learn to develop as practices. And I'm currently in the third year of a four-year vocational training, it is, and something which in the Netherlands is called ecotherapy, and which I call, when I'm speaking to English or American folks, really systemic energy tuning. And I call it that because ecotherapy is already an existing field of kind of taking people into nature and helping them heal their splits, also very valid, but not the same as this. And what the systemic energy tuning essentially is, it's great. It's based on 20 years of work that was done in Germany originally with the Institute of Resonance Therapy, where they take all the kind of concepts that Lynn McTaggart talks about in her work in the field, that Rupert Sheldrake's morphic field, all of these kind of ideas, the quantum physics theory, and they turned it into a practice of healing at energetic level, large areas of land. So in Germany, they were experimenting with that for a long period at a distance. So, you know, they have a map of the land, and they were using basically symbols and things that have certain resonance that they would connect to the map, and that depending on what the system needed, that would bring the system into energetic coherence. And they had biology university researchers checking on impact, and they've got all this data that says this makes a difference. You know, these trees or these ecosystems were, what the main thing that happened was that they were able to deal with challenges that they were facing more effectively. So they became more resilient as ecosystems. Some of the most popular people on the training courses, the groups who like this work most on the training courses in the Netherlands now are farmers and flower growers. Why? Because they see it work. Because they see people, these guy, you know, this kind of in my group, there's a dairy farmer. And he says, well, my cows are far healthier than anybody else's. I have to use less drugs and everything. They produce more milk. And what's more, my relationship with my wife and has improved as well, because the whole system gets balanced. So there's this level of work at what I call the energetic architecture, which I feel is key, because it's going to accelerate the impact that we can have. And it works in a space which, for me, is the simplicity, the other side of complexity, ultimately. So I feel we've got this energetic architecture that up until now we've been working primarily at the level of relational architecture. So, you know, helping people work together more effectively, improving the relationships between people in order to get greater impact at the material architecture. Think about it, that material architecture results, stuff that gets done and achieved. Relational architecture transcends and includes that, holds the space for stuff to be materialized. And then energetic architecture is the container for all of that. And what we notice in this work is when you get the energetic architecture coherent, the relationships align and stuff gets done more effectively as well. So my sense is there's a world out there that we need to start to develop practices in that is essentially resonant with yellow turquoise sense of reality. In fact, we're going to be running the very first ecotherapy training in English in the Netherlands, 19th to the 23rd of September. As soon as I came across this work, Hans has been teaching it over here for 5 or 6 years in the Netherlands, and I was, where's nobody doing this in English language? So for the very first time, we're going to be doing that this September, and I'm looking forward to developing that as well, because I feel we've really got a discipline and a practice that one can learn that enables us to work at that level. It's not like, oh, I just do the course and then it's all solved. As part of it, you have to do a lot of your own inner work, and a condition is that you do some kind of intuitive development work, because basically, you know, until we start clearing out our own inner world so that we can see clearly in a clairvoyant state, then it's very hard for us to discern these different energies. So there's that kind of work that's coming on. I've been doing some research into different energy generating technologies that are out there that work from a similar field. And one of the very interesting things about these technologies is that essentially they're consciousness driven. So intention turns them on and off. And what you see is that the developers of these kind of technologies, they're sometimes called zero point or ether technologies if people are Steiner influenced. And that if somebody enters the team, or if the intention in the team shifts to, let's say, just use, you know, producing this thing to make more money, the product development stops, just grinds to a halt. The stuff stops working. And it's when there's a clear intention that this work they are doing, these things they are trying to produce, these objects they're trying to produce are for the good of the whole, then the product development keeps going. So there's a number of these that are very close at the moment to realization. So I'm kind of watching those, because when we get access to that kind of technology, that's the end of the oil-driven technology. They will be the technologies you can have in your house, basically, that you'll be able to just presence energy for all of our needs. But it is interesting how they relate to the consciousness. It feels like it's a kind of safeguard. It's a very interesting and fairly unknown. I feel like a complete schoolboy in that whole area. But there's many different aspects of this consciousness now that's coming in, from the kind of ecotherapy, energetic tuning work, to hardcore technologies that are actually coming through right now. So in all of that, we can get kind of carried away with that, but remember what I said, in that we only get access to that when we've healed the split down, purple, beige, purple into red. When we've healed the precognitive unity split, then the whole thing can kind of come into alignment again, and that post-cognitive unity is released and revealed. We get to go beyond the veil of Isis. Now, when I was with Wisdom University in Chartres recently, Jim Garrison framed the theme of the week. We were doing sacred geometry, and was the theme for the whole week. And he said, my little thing for the week is saying that nature likes to hide. Nature likes to hide. The nature of reality likes to hide. And he said, this is translated out of the Greek word to hide, actually means to hide from the mind. So the real nature of reality likes to hide from the mind. You know, anyone who's tried to, anyone who's tried to go beyond the veil of Isis, through with mental capacity, through a place of kind of ego split, as it were, gets burnt to a cinder. So we only get access to beyond the veil of Isis, as it were, once we've done our inner work, and kind of hold that resonance and frequency, which enables us to open the veil. So I think I'll just hold it there for now. That's kind of good, and see what questions come up, and trust that anything else that I have to say will come at the right time, depending on what the need is out there. So thanks for your attention. Thanks for holding the field. It certainly helped me anyway.
Thank you, Peter. And I feel like I should apologize for downplaying my introduction of you after that. I want to remind everybody that if you have comments or questions, that you press 1 on your phone keypad or your Skype keypad. And I can't believe there aren't in every one of you a host of questions that have emerged from this. And I will get to you in just a moment. I wanted to share with you statement by Leonardo da Vinci. Simplicity is the ultimate sophistication, which seems to fit with part of what you were talking about, Peter. And the thing that I'm most struck by is just the extraordinary scope of what you've managed to put together in a few 45 minutes. I'm also reminded of, you know, Don Beck's admonition that I have heard many times, that our task is to make the spiral healthy. And and that, I think, is one of the themes that emerges from what you're talking about. But you've added on to that a quality of spirit and a quality of attention, not just internal, but to context, that allows us potentially to access all kinds of energies that perhaps we're not normally thinking about or including. One other thing about that healing process, before I go to the questions, is your reference to the Great Mother archetype, and what I'm reminded of in Jung's work is the shadow side as well, because the Great Mother, of course, is the great nurturer. But when nurturing is overdone, then it's suffocation. And so finding those places in those energies that are nurturing, that are generative, that are helping us tap into nature in a way, even when it's trying to hide, that we can use our energies in a generative fashion. May sound awfully green, you know. But let's face it, I'm at heart green as green can be, and you know, if I ever see anything called second tier in this lifetime, I'll be amazed. But in any case, maybe it flashes every now and then. I get to states instead of stages. All right. So, any comments to what I said? Yeah.
Yes, please. Yeah, yeah. Just you reminded me nicely of something. And that's the, you know, there's been all these things on the role of the men and the masculine, and there's been all this feminine stuff. And one of the key things which, you know, when I was saying earlier that we've had this big transcendent trip, it's all been about transcend, get out of the body, you know, transcend the earth. It's all been transcend as we've been, you know, afraid in a way of somehow going back into that imminent, deep, dark kind of feminine of the earth and the body. That we've done the same with the feminine. You know, the transcendent feminine is like the Mary figure, or in the church, the feminine is only allowed to be either a virgin or a whore. You know, and there's another half the story, the transcendent feminine. You know, this beautiful kind of light, but we forget the immanent or the descendant feminine. And when I was in Chartres, we sat with the Black Madonna. If you ever get a chance to go to Chartres, go down into the crypt and sit with the Black Madonna. And there's that other side to the feminine. And I tell you, it's the Dark Mother is full of wrath at the moment. And it's the wrath of, like, the child that runs out in front of the car, and the mother pulls the child back and is wrathful because of the risk that she sees and the ignorance in the child. And the dark feminine in Gaia at the moment in the earth is full of wrath, essentially. And we're about to experience the dark feminine. And remembering that, just as creation is sacred, so is death and destruction. Death and destruction is as sacred as creation, and we're gonna have to learn to integrate dark and light ultimately if we're interested in unity consciousness. But thanks for reminding that. I forgot to say that piece about the kind of transcendent and immanent feminine, but it's really key for what's happening at this time.
Thanks, Peter. I'm going to turn first to the northwestern part of the United States. Aaliyah, you have a question or an observation?
Yes, I do. Wow, this whole talk was like drops of water on my soul. this is definitely where I live and where I work. So it's extremely exciting. I guess the question is, I haven't read Up from Eden, so the only one that I've ever come across who addresses the why of this split that you mentioned is Rhian Eisler.
Mm.
And it seems to me that we can't heal something unless we know the fundamental cause of it. And I'd love to hear you talk more about why that happened historically. You're saying that it happened historically and it also happens within each individual. So my question is, what do you think, feel, know, intuit, sense about why?
Well, Leah, I mean, can you just tell me what you think about that? You know, what does Rhian Eisler? I don't know the name. I don't know the work. What have you picked up from that about the course?
Well, in her book Sacred Pleasure and the previous book The Chalice and the Blade, they're both foundational. If I ruled the world, everyone would read them. Historically, she traces it to people from the colder climes way back in, we're talking like prehistory times, people from the colder climes developed child-rearing practices that were far harsher, more violent, more anti-body because of the harsh conditions that they lived in. And they came into the parts of the world that were more, shall we say, healthy purple, more in unity with the earth. And they brought somehow their culture, it's been a while since I read this, their cultural ways, they stamped out the other. That's why you got the genocide of earth worshipping women. That's where that all arose from. And so, it's, strangely enough, it actually, I think for her, originates in the climate conditions, and then the downstream from that, and how that has resulted in our unhealthy patriarchy and our unhealthy feminine. And it's really the historical sweep, and she pays attention to the upper left too a lot, is pretty amazing. So now tell me your view.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, I quite honestly, I don't necessarily have a...
If I could just add, there are a couple of key concepts in her work that Aaliyah is referring to, that we have ultimately developed what are called dominator societies in the world, and that essentially what she's offering as an alternative model is partnership systems.
Yeah, I forgot that concept.
Particularly... between genders, but extending around. So,
well, to be quite honestly, I mean, I don't actually know why. You know, it resonated with me when I read Up from Eden, and it kind of clicked a lot of things into place, as Ken describes that process. But the cause of that, you know, the why that happened in certain places, I mean, I saw all sorts of consequences, of course, and the, you know, as the church got into power, the fear that there was of that energy. I mean, it's a powerful, of course, the raw precognitive, you know, that raw energy is powerful, and the church, when it got into place, wanted that controlled and the power to be held by them, you know. So there was a lot of stuff that led on from that. But what the original cause of the split was, I actually don't know. I'd be really interested in anyone else's views. And certainly Rihanna could well be, you know, life conditions again. Life conditions that lead to a certain practice. And at that point in time, you don't know the consequences of it. But that could well be one of the reasons.
Okay, I'm going to go to Victoria next and then to Susan. Victoria, you're on.
Great. Hey, thank you, Peter. This is just really... quite amazing. It's really resonating with me at lots of different levels. I'm wondering about the effects of collective being in severe pain and wanting to distance itself from that pain as a way of disassociating and climbing out of its skin. I do counseling work, and I know that's certainly true for a lot of people in their own personal journey, that they disassociate when there's too much discomfort because they haven't been taught how to lean into the feeling and work with it, you know, and actually ground it and let it process all the way through. So I kind of wondered about that idea of going from purple to red, about is there a process of where we start doing mind over matter rather than relationship between mind and matter, or even, you know, mind as matter. So that was one of the things that crossed my mind when I listened to you and Aaliyah chatting about that.
Yeah, I think that. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, totally. I think that you know, moving away from pain and the discomfort, I think that split is one of the biggest, certainly, you know, my personal experience, one of the biggest pains I've had to confront. You know, the fact that we've forgotten that we are actually the earth. Just a little, you know, if we just allow that to sink in, you know, the fact we've forgotten that fundamentally we are the earth, and look what we've done to ourselves. Just look, you know, just let it in. How could we have done that? I mean, there's huge pain there. And so how we can sit with that in healthy ways, and Joanna's work, you know, Joanna Macy's work, which she called despair and empowerment, the connecting, the just allowing, accessing the emotions that are present, you know, as we allow ourselves to allow that to be true, allow it to be true that we've forgotten who we are and ultimately done what we have to the planet, what the emotions are. And then out of that process comes the empowerment, you know, as we allow that to be true and move, as you say, move into holding pain. I think you're right, you know, ultimately our society is designed to numb ourselves, to numb pain at many, many levels. You know, I think so much of our infotainment and entertainment world, you know, the TV, it's all about numbing us. It's like I have a baby boy, right? It's like about a dummy. I have this sense we've got a collective dummy or pacifier, I think you call it in the States, in our mouths right now to stop us feeling anything. We need to pull the friggin' dummy out, you know, and allow ourselves to scream in a safe held environment, ideally. But if not, then not. You know, but ultimately, yeah, sitting with that pain, allowing that kind of primal scream, as it were, of the split. So I think absolutely key and sort of really important work to be done there.
I know in my own personal healing work and healing my own pains that there was a combination between finally feeling the pain, not just emotionally, but where it lives in my body. My body's conscious of the pain. And then to open to something larger than the pain. And there are pains that are, at a human level, are so big that the only thing that's large enough to embrace them is that energetic spirit.
Right.
You know, to go all the way to the source to find the soothing and the container that's large enough to hold that.
Yeah, that's right. That's why we have to do both at the same time. Yeah. That's why we have to do the half.
I would love to actually hear about more of your own meditation body energy practice, if you wouldn't mind sharing just a little bit about that.
Okay, just shortly. I mean, you know, there was a moment after the meditation practice for 5 or 6 years or something that I kind of walking around and I'm kind of, oh, look, I don't need to sit on the cushion anymore to get this this state. Mm-hmm. And then something else starts to shift. And the work I actually came across initially was Dronvalo Melchizedek's work on the Merkaba light body, and that there's a certain practice around that that I worked with, which probably what it was ultimately doing was kind of releasing the Kundalini and working with that energy. And then I got into, I've done kind of different variations around Tai Chi and Lu, which is more the kind of self-defense form. And then when I discovered Dylan's work, the Uzazu work, that's been my practice since then, because the power of it is, it for me, it combines the integral framework, as it were, and the energy and the body work. So, you know, with that practice, if I'm kind of rushed in the morning, I can do like 15, 20 minutes. I can go beige, turquoise, turquoise down to beige through a set of body and sound movements. It's great. You know, kind of, and then I know which system is out of sync for that day because my, you know, my movement feels a little awkward or something. So I'm finding that practice, the Uzazu practice, which is UZAZU, if anyone's interested in following that up, to be extremely valuable, extremely valuable.
Thanks, Peter. Let's go on to Susan. We have a couple more questions after that, Benjamin and Jennifer, so keep them coming.
Thanks, Russ. This is Susan. Can you hear me okay?
Can you hear me? Yes, ma'am.
Pardon me? Oh, good.
Yes, we hear you.
Thank you kindly. I am relatively new to the integral theory, but I absolutely love it. It resonates well with me, and I've enjoyed this diverse collaboration. We've talked a lot about leaders and organizations and entrepreneurs, and I'm curious, when I listen to you today, Peter, as you look across the integral community, do you see it, I know you're grounded in it, being highly connected to everything that you're doing? Are there gaps that you're seeing? Are we close to a tipping point based on where you're going?
Well, let me say, for one, I've, you know, the integral community has been key to my development over the years, both Ken's writings and the community of people around that. The thing which I'm noticing, which I feel needs more attention from the integral community, you know, the big theme and mantra for me as well over the years has been transcend and include. And I have a sense that actually what we need to do right now is descend and include. We've almost like been hijacked by Orange in this kind of, let's get to second tier. Oh, well, we'll add it. Let's do third tier. And, oh, maybe we can add another one on top, you know. Man, that's not integral. That's raw Orange. It's like, let's get to the top. And that, it's that kind of transcendent, pure, like, that's only half the story, you know. And if we don't, it's like a tree. Just think of a tree, you know, if a tree, as it branches, expand out, it needs to send its roots. Otherwise, it's going to be blown over, you know. I was talking with a woman the other day who said, yeah, well, the way we think about it, and she said, we as women, is like, I do the roots thing first, and then the branches just open up and expand. And I'm kind of, oh, that's interesting. As a man, I think what I do is I kind of push my branches out, and then I start to wobble and realize I need to dig my roots deeper. So, like, we need to do some canal root work, you know. We need to dig ourselves deeper. And in fact, when Dylan and I were working with Spiral and this the whole kind of integral model in a non-linear way, so we were looking for the non-linear rather than kind of one-way evolutionary, but the non-linear model around it. Instead of transcend and include, we talked about expand and embrace, because we actually, the concept, I think, is more of a spiral, but more of a torus. If you're familiar with, like, a torus is that kind of donut form, that where energy kind of comes into the center and then spins out to the perimeter and then comes in a toroidal form. But actually, that's the kind of key form that we need to be thinking in terms of. And it's as we, as it expands out more broadly, it gets denser at the center. You know, there's more crystalline form at the center. And that's the, that kind of image of expand and embrace more. So I think one of the things which I would like to see us looking at more in the integral community is just put a little check on the kind of transcend stuff and look at how do we look at things in another way and maybe do a bit of descend and include, not a separate from, but related to the transcend work, expand and embrace.
Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. I'm relatively new to where I'm living now, Peter. I moved to Tucson, Arizona a little over a year ago. And one of the things that I've been trying to have time to work on, I seem not to have enough, is to make a connection to the local community. And this means politically as well as somewhat socially and the like. And it just seems to me that one of the ways that we have, we're going to include the context, one of the ways that we have for that deepening that you're suggesting around the roots is the investment in the arena where we can make a difference. And sometimes that's through working with not-for-profits. Like one of the things we do is we help to Hispanics register, go through the registration process, and file for citizenship. So you get involved in actions like that and so on. That somehow our grounding is very near to us. We don't have to just be thinking in terms of how do we impact starvation in Africa. How do we impact starvation in our own communities is probably just as important a question.
Yeah, absolutely, Rusty. Thank you. Remind me of, like, often I'll talk about three key things to focus on, and today I mentioned two of them, the first being context, the second being capacities and qualities, you know, and consciousness that we need to develop, and the third being community, because as we move into this time of turbulence, the thing we're really going to be needing to nurture is resilient community. Because at many, many different levels, from kind of transition town level where we ensure that our community is able to access basic needs independent of the big grids, because like food supply is going to come under pressure, clean water supply, energy supply, all of those things which we kind of take for granted as being provided for us as we go into this turbulence, those are going to come under stress. And those systems, those large grids, are not resilient. And the food supply chain is the best example. So, you know, our supermarkets are going to be in trouble because that whole supply chain is going to start to break down. So we need to make sure that we have a resilient community at that level, that we're thinking about how do we meet our needs more locally. And then also just at the level of relationships, you know, if we take what I just said as the kind of lower right quadrant, the we level, are we investing in the quality of relationship in our community? That means that the fabric of that culture, that fabric of our neighborhood is going to hold and be able to stretch as the shift hits the fan, or is it going to crack and are people going to contract into their own needs and are we essentially going to get into conflict about meeting basic needs, or can we hold it together? And yeah, our practice ground is right where we live. You know, it's right in our local community. So whatever we can find to do that enables us to help build that resilience in our community. And the community can also be our organization. You know, how are our organizations going to navigate this time? And then, of course, our individual resilience, bring in like upper right quadrant. You know, are we looking after ourselves energetically, food-wise? Are we drinking 2 liters of water a day? All the simple things that we often forget when we're activists in the world or we're kind of spiritual practitioners or whatever, we kind of forget the body again. So to make sure that we're looking after ourselves, because, you know, burnt out activist is no good to anyone. So how we nurture resilience at many levels, and particularly at a community level, you know, how we live somewhere, we're going to have to live somewhere. I don't want to be in a big city, I'll tell you, in the next few years, because they're the least resilient places we have on the planet. But how are we going to build resilience into our corner of the city? You know, key questions at the moment.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because ecologists are kind of touting the big city as the ecological step to the future. That's going to be an interesting or a challenging aspect of how we move forward. Let's go on to Benjamin. You have a question, Benjamin?
Hi, yes. I first wanted to say thank you for this whole conversation. It was wonderful.
Pleasure, thanks.
And, I mean, there's a lot of questions that I could ask. I think what you brought up, what you just kind of brought up with the kind of collapse of our institutions and food systems and all of that is one of the things that I've been looking at for a little while now. I'm only 22, so I'm not that well versed in it, but there's plenty of things on the internet about it. And I find that there's a lot of fear-based anticipation and expectations about what's going to happen. And so there's almost in order to more comprehensively prepare for these, that's where I see so much of the work that we were talking about or that you were talking about today coming in, with expanding and embracing and opening people up to these energetic possibilities and new world views. And at that point, I start to get really optimistic, and I say, well, it doesn't need to collapse the way that so many people are fearing that it needs to or that it's going to. And I do see, preparation and transition towns as necessary. But then there's something in me that says, well, we can do so much more than that. Why not focus on transforming these terrible food distribution systems into something that really does make sense? So I don't know if you heard a question in there, but I'm going to turn it back over.
Yeah, thanks. I did hear a question, and it's been a key one for me over the last years. And I have also, as the question as I heard it, is the stuff we can do to kind of to respond and adaptive solutions in a way that enable us to be resilient locally. But I heard you also say, can't we also be transforming, trying to transform the current system, kind of mitigation in a way? And I think we need to do both. I think we need to work on how do we shift the supply chains, and some of the work that's been done out of the Netherlands, which Barrett Brown has been involved in, has been working on the supply chains and making them more sustainable, and I've worked in these big organizations. And, at the moment, to be honest with you, if I look at the capacity that I see in these organizations and in their leadership structures to change in the way that is needed, I'm not optimistic, to be quite honest. And, I've earned my buck doing that work. But the culture is so embedded and the structures are so strong that hold people in that space. And they are, I had somebody in a leadership team once who had been in that team 18 years ago and then dropped out and then came back in, and he said, it's exactly the same pattern. It's different people, exactly the same pattern. But the kind of level shift that we're going to need in our existing institutions to make that happen, I'm not sure if that's possible. So at the moment, my sense is what is needed is to find this new stuff that's emerging, the stuff that works, and amplify it and accelerate it. I think it's Buckminster Fuller who said, don't try to change the old system, but build a new one that makes the old one obsolete. So my challenge and invitation to those of us who are seeing this at this time is that don't blame the old guard. Don't blame the folks in power at the moment. Somebody's got to keep the lights on. Someone's got to deliver me electricity so I can be part of this call with you guys right now. Someone's got to do that, and they're trying to run the system. Conditions. They don't have the mental space to reinvent civilization. That's going to have to come from the fringes, from the understream, that's the undercurrents that are going on. It's actually our responsibility to create the alternatives and get them as mature as we can, as quickly as possible, so that they're mature enough to take over the reins from the old system and those guys can let go. And I can tell you a lot of them know that. A lot of them know exactly what's happening. I mean, they get their intelligence. They can see the storm coming, and they're going, I don't know what to do. All I know is I've got to keep supplying electricity or keep supplying, food or whatever it is that their business is. And so somebody else is going to have to come up with the alternatives. And that can realistically take over and go, okay, we're ready. And that's our work. That's our work. So we need to make sure we don't get into a blame game. Let's hold our hearts open for the people who are trying to run the world at the moment. I'm sure there are also folks with bad intentions. I'm not naive about that. But there's also very good people in there who are really struggling with knowing what's happening and not knowing what to do and not the time or space in their current institution to be able to deal with it. So, I wouldn't, you know, if anybody's energy out there is transforming, trying to transform the old systems, I'm open to that possibility. I just, in my kind of years so far, that's not where I would put my energy. I find the new emerging stuff, help it to be smart, help it grow, help it to go viral, amplify and accelerate, get it as mature as possible so that we're ready to take over the helm as the other stuff comes under increasing stress.
Excuse me. Thank you very much. I'm sorry, I just choked. Jennifer, take over.
Are you okay, Russ? God bless.
I just got so excited that you were going to ask a question.
I know, right? Yeah. speaking of choking, my whole body is choking on the amount of energy that's coming up right now. I'm so glad you started us out with some face-holding meditation because it really seems to me that especially Western culture is really choked. I mean, we are choked at this point. There's such a huge amount of resistance to what you are suggesting. And I feel it. You know, my body's screaming it right now at me. I'm hearing it. I'm seeing it everywhere. I'm even seeing it inside of Integral. And I'm just so glad that you had that larger space within which to bring this up because it's really necessary. I noticed you had you put a lot of energy into your meaning making around all this, and I totally support that. And I'm so glad that you're doing the meaning making inside the larger space. To me, that totally makes this valid, and that's where the next move is going to have to come from. If it comes from an unconscious place that's purely coming out of the chokehold, it's going to be too violent. It's going to be too red. It's going to be too, you know, dark mother. She's pit, right? I mean, we all get it. And that's, you know, the unhealthy green comes from that angry place. And so many people are turned off by the energy of the anger that they're just like completely shutting out the message. And that only makes it worse. So I'm just really grateful that you opened that larger space within which to bring this up. That is absolutely critical. So God bless. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, as we're talking here today, I'm aware that in Dallas, Texas, the Spiral Dynamics Integral Confab is going on, and Don Beck and Roberto Bonilla and Fred Kwachuk and just a bunch of people from around the world are there taking a look at the use of functional analysis and the use of mesh working in trying to address a lot of significant issues that are being faced in the world, from gang violence in Mexico to the addressing the economy in Iceland to dealing with the Middle East and growing Palestine, if you will, and in a healthy way. I'm wondering if you could take just a few minutes, and then I'll get on to Linda Barron's question, to talk about the methodologies of Spiral Dynamics Integral and what you see their role being in initiating new institutions and the like.
Russ, you're asking me to do that in 2 minutes? No, man.
Well, give us a hint.
I mean, what Spiral does, you know, is one, it's a map. It's a map of the landscape. So don't confuse the landscape with the map. It's very important. But it's a good map, and I like the way it's held by Don in particular. And it's the first thing it helps us to do is see clearly. It helps us to see the landscape, to see where we are. And ultimately, you know, as we look at these different energies surging up across the planet, it helps us to see them in perspective. And as we see the, you know, what's going on in the Arab Spring, as it's been called, and things, and the debate comes around, well, what are the new governance structures, or, you know, how are we going to support these societies in their next step? The question is, who are they from a value system? So who are these people? What value system are they resonating at right now? And therefore, what's the appropriate system infrastructure for them that's going to meet them where they are at. So when you've got a kind of upsurge of purple, red beginning to come into blue, what you don't want to do is put in a green kind of representative democracy structure, as we've seen in Afghanistan and Iraq, the struggles with that. We need to put in place stuff that fits people where they're at. And that's the key design principle, you know, behind spiral dynamics. Not the thing that we think is best, but the thing that is needed most in that context. Don often will talk about stratified democracy. So as we look at different societies, you can see them, their center of gravity being at different places on the spiral. So the kind of democratic form, from authoritarian democracy through to representative democracy and all that's in between, is to find the form that fits the interior dynamics of that place. And of course, that's a principle that can be applied anywhere. But it requires a real discipline of us to be able to look clearly and not project onto other contexts the thing that we get most excited about at the moment, because probably what we get most excited about isn't the thing that necessarily fits the context we're looking at. So that's the key design principle, really, Russ, of like get a sense of what the need in the context, what are the life conditions, what are the active, the centers of gravity, the value system, and then where are the best examples in the world of governance systems, for example, or organizational forms that fit those value systems in those contexts, and then have the local people, the people in that context, design their system from some of those principles. And of course, we can have stories of inspiration from other places. You certainly don't want to cut and paste stuff into different cultures. You know, they'll find their own form, and if with our kind of with the spiral in the background, we can help to see what the basic. Architecture of that form would be, and then the local cultures will flesh out the details to fit with them in their specific life conditions and specific context.
Great, thank you. Let's go on to Linda Behrens. How are you doing today, Linda?
I'm doing great now. I've not been so moved in a long time, and I've been around a long time. And I have one is just a request. I was so engaged emotionally and mentally in what you were saying, Peter, that I couldn't capture all the resources you mentioned. So mm-hmm. I'm wondering if we can get a list posted to the message board.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is, as I was looking at various approaches to working with people, Stegen, who's working with organizations where they are, and then Holacracy, which is a mm-hmm. completely different system, and having been around as Holacracy was being formed and knowing how well it meets mm-hmm. the needs of different personality types, I just wondered if you knew what you think that that has some promise, if you know about it, and that was it.
Yeah, thank you, Linda.
Me as well, your comments. Holacracy. Thank God for Holacracy. That's all I can say. It's over here. Just as, you know, Brian was giving it form, really. He came over and trained a number of us in it maybe three, four years ago now. And we were struggling with all the traditional kind of strategic planning and business plan. We just went round and round in circles, and basically we were horribly stuck. And then we adopted Holacracy. Wow. And it just completely released us. And the key element, so I think absolutely it's relevant at the moment, and absolutely it's like a DNA that can be tailored to many different contexts and value systems. And the essence of it, I think the essences for me are obviously the concept of dynamic steering, so that we are not trying to predict and control, but we're dealing with a rapidly changing world and environment that, you know, you take one step and everything changes. And so we can't do more than that, really. As Meg Wheatley often says, it's like sense and act and sense and act and sense and act. And what Holacracy has given us is a practice, organizational practice, that fits a kind of second-tier culture in the interior. That's how we kind of felt it. It's like a presencing practice. You know, it continually makes us presence ourselves to the tensions now. And if it's not a tension now, then forget it. Don't waste your time on it. But what are the tensions now, and what's the and what's the solution that the collective intelligence can best come up with that's workable for now? Not maybe for the next 5 years or even 2 years or even 6 months or even 2 months. You know, we meet every month. So do we reckon this is workable for the next month? Yes, good. Adopt, go. Implement. and then we'll see. You know, then we'll see if any tensions come up, and we'll address them as they do. So the power of the dynamic steering concept, or the power of workability as a concept, the only question that's important is it workable for now? Does this solution fit within the systemic needs of this organization, or does it stretch the boundaries too far, basically? And if it's workable, then we go with it. And the process, the integrative decision-making process that is designed to hear every voice in the system, not in such a way because, not from the perspective of because every voice needs to be heard and included, but because we know that different people present different pieces of the puzzle. Like Brian often talks about the indicators on the dashboard, you know, of a cockpit. You don't kind of ignore the fuel gauge because it's a little irritating in its flashingness, you know, because otherwise you're in trouble. So it deals a lot with the, with the kind of people who speak the shadow in the system, who we often move away from because, as one of our earlier contributors said, it's hard to hold the pain and be with the pain. But can we see all the contributions as information from the field, as information from the system? And that practice has been extremely valuable for us in coming up with, you know, solutions that have enabled us to just keep going. I mean, that's the key thing. It's like in these times particularly, just keep moving and allow the system to grow organically out of the kind of context that it's embedded in, rather than creating, you know, in a vacuum. But what are the tensions? What are the needs? So I would highly recommend Holacracy as an organizational practice to anybody out there. It's really helped us as a center for human emergency to get our stuff together and keep going. So, thanks for mentioning that.
Yeah, that's an example of building a better system, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it does require a certain, you know, it's a practice you have to learn and be ready to learn. So it requires good quality facilitation as well. So you have to be, you know, quite sensitive who you're doing it with and make sure, you know, give people a chance and coach them in it. And, you know, it does take time. You know, we actually said in the CHE, we adopted it like as law for 6 months. We said we're going to apply it in its pure form. Everett Bryan said we should do in its pure form for 6 months, and we did. And at the end of that 6 months, we evaluated it, and then we adapted it a bit, you know, to meet our needs and our way of doing things more. But it was good to really try it out hardcore, full on, every single kind of rule which they'd given us, because that, you know, enabled us to really get a sense of what it was and how it contributed, and then where we felt its limitations were in terms of the kind of organization and people we were.
I did want to comment to Linda and others that if you didn't get the resources, there will be posted on the webpage for Peter's presentation a recording of this, as well as notes. And I will encourage the note taker to be sure to list the references that he has made. In the meanwhile, why don't we go to someone who's in the Netherlands? Farino, you have a question.
Yes, you talked about the connection between beige and purple and yellow and turquoise, and I was wondering if you could kind of talk a bit more about that connection and then also maybe the differences that that come up there.
Okay. I mean, essentially, the thing that connects them is that one is precognitive and one is postcognitive, or one is pre-ego and one set is post-ego, you know, so beige and... When we looked at it, we kind of distinguishing things out with Dylan, exploring it in the body. Essentially, beige, purple, and yellow, turquoise have yin as their foundation. Their basic assumption is connection, is connectedness. That's what connects them up. And red through to green are essentially yang based, as their basic, their foundational energy. So they're based on separation, distinction, discernment. So that's you know, that's the basic thing that connects them, is that they're rooted in. Both or four of those are rooted in connectedness. Of course, the difference is the ego in the middle. And what that does in a healthy way, you know, when red emerges healthily, is we get this individuation process where we're able to see ourselves and clearly and distinctly, and therefore we're able to act on and with our environment and surrounding. And so when we get up to yellow turquoise and we start to re-embrace beige purple in this way, then we're bringing with us the whole, it's like yin with all that yang included in it. You know, if you think of it as these expanding circles, it's like those fields of beige, purple, yellow, turquoise are fields that hold the yang systems in the middle. They're like, so they're holding fields. I heard a really nice, I read actually in another great book by a guy called Alistair McIntosh called Hell and High Water, which looks at climate change, but then also the human condition around it. And he made this very nice distinction between, you know, when red emerges healthily, we get an individuation process where the individual crystallizes out, but it's still held in the collective. But what happened in our industrialized societies, instead of the individuation, we got an individualization. So instead of being these individuals being held in a collective, we were unrooted, disconnected to the context, essentially, which meant we were kind of running around, you know, like headless chickens, essentially. And so that's a really useful distinction to make, you know, between individuation and individualization. In fact, what we saw in London, you know, in the riots was a great example of the disrootedness and the individualization rather than individuation. You know, in a lot of traditional cultures, there was this, what we did around purple-red, where there were these initiation ceremonies for young men and probably young women as well. I don't actually know much about that. But the young men that as the testosterone kicked in, you know, the elders would help these young men to be able to manage that energy in service of the community, so that yang kind of surge of energy could be held in the context of the whole. And essentially what we saw in London was a bunch of uninitiated men, and there were women involved in that as well. And on my blog, actually, on petermerry.org, there's a piece by Edwin Holweder, who's one of our folks over here at the CHE, called London Calling, where he describes very beautifully that piece. So anyway, that was a bit of a sidetrack from your question, but I think an important point. So the thing that connects them is they're basically yin-based systems, and the thing which differentiates them is the fact that the yang in between, so that we've been able to individuate out, see ourselves, and then re-embrace. In fact, Dylan was saying the other day that there's a brain scientist who was looking at how the neocortex, what it actually needs to do in the brain is to loop back round into the reptilian and mammalian brain. So it kind of literally transcends and includes, wraps around into them, roots itself back into those brains. That's the kind of image of what we need to do. But the neocortex has emerged first. So we've had that set of systems in between that's given us the ability to see ourselves clearly, create conscious collective agreements through blue and everything. It's just maturity, distinction between them. And it holds a world cosmocentric perspective. So whereas in pure purple, before it emerged, it was very much ethnocentric. So we would be at war, tribal war, basically, with each other. So what the world centrism and cosmocentrism has given us is obviously the value set, that decides it's probably not a good idea to go to war. You know, more of a sense of ourselves as a global citizen, whereas in purple we were more of a tribal member with us then dynamics going on, much more accentuated polarities, of course.
Well, you know, we're really getting over our time here, but we still have questions, and I think the exchange is so valuable, I think I'll just extend the question and answer period, if that's all right with you, Peter?
Sure, Russ, fine. Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, then let's go to Laurie Baker and see... what's your question, please, Laurie?
Thank you, Russ. Peter, I said at the beginning of this call that I was very interested in your presentation, and I want to thank you. You have far exceeded my expectations, and I'm very grateful. I have thoroughly enjoyed this, and I hear the Celtic music in the lyrical and poetic wisdom that you share with us, and you sort of vibrate through me like music. I know I hear your words, but I feel you, and I just want to say thank you. I had a couple of things I wanted to share really quickly with you. When you were speaking about the symbols that the Wanagar members were doing with the land, how they showed a, you know, there was a response, I just wanted to comment really quickly that reminds me of my favorite artist, Andrea Bocelli, who bought a large parcel of land in his homeland of Latico in Italy, and it is left to go fallow for the whole year. It's called the Teatro de Silencio, and it is made to be silent and to sort of gather energy for his once-a-year concert. And then after the concert, he invites in the world. The world comes to hear him, and then the land goes silent again in preparation for next year's concert at the Teatro del Valencia, the Theater of Silence. Beautiful. I wanted to share that. But I wanted to sort of more directly feature your topic of descending and transcending the trends for the transition. And to bring it to a personal level, for myself, descending is where I face my pain and my shadow that I'm in denial about and I'm afraid to face and I'm overwhelmed by it and I'm terrified by what I might find there. But I am, there's a certain fearlessness and I face it. And it's always, my fear of it is far worse than the actuality of it every time, which I'm grateful for. And I have to always remind myself of that because every time I just get in this grip of fear of facing it. But I have to say that I have spent my life avoiding that aspect of myself. And, you know, who wants to do that? Oh, that's just terrible. Oh, that's so negative. Oh, no, don't. No. But the gift that I get when I do that, Peter, is beyond measure. What I get is a new opening inside of myself. And in this opening, I receive the most tremendous gifts that are available to me. I find my strength. I, in fact, find I am invulnerable in doing this exercise, and that it is incredibly powerful and enormously healing. And as you can hear, it gives me this ability and this freedom to express myself personally at great depth. It is an inner experience, and I am the expert on that, and I can share it with authority and clarity. And so when I look at your topic tonight, this morning, descending and transcending, that is my personal experience, is descending into my shadow and owning it and taking responsibility for it and healing it, and I transcend it, and I transcend to a far greater place and power and connection. And in thinking of this personally, something that's occurring in my life I'm sort of curious about, and you don't have to speak on it, so I'm just commenting on it. I am finding old problems. I've been married 29 years, and happily, I love my husband, and my husband loves me, but there are old patterns and problems that I'm finding or repeating that were noticed in our early years of marriage. And I'm not very impressed, and I'm certainly not happy about it. And I'm sure somebody would enlighten me what the heck that is, because, you know, I mean, it's just something else I have to go through, you know. I'll go kicking and screaming, but I'll get there. And so, you know, doing this work personally, I don't really know how, but I'm sure somehow, and possibly you could answer this, when we do this work personally, Peter, doesn't it somehow benefit this transition? This is the mystery, you know, that somehow it will help the transition in the world by doing it, you know, internally first.
Yeah, of course, Laurie, man. I mean, yeah. I mean, it's like we are the world. I mean, this is a holographic universe we live in. We're totally a fractal. So when we transform that in ourselves, we transform the pattern in the world. That's the great thing, but that's also the scary thing, because it means that every single pattern that we express in ourselves is impacting the collective field around us. So in terms of like responsibility for not just our behavior, but our thoughts and the way we relate to the world, other than us, and relate to ourselves. Now, everything that happens inside of us is reflected around us. So it's not just does it slightly, it is. I mean, it's the same thing. So, and we transmute it in ourselves, and there's the work to do in the world around us, so we meet the patterns in our relationships. I totally agree with you, same kind of thing with my wife, same patterns come back. I'm kind of, God damn, man, what's that pattern doing in there again? I thought I'd dealt with that, and it's just another layer, you know, that needs to be peeled off. But I think what seems to increase in me in any way is the ability not to be triggered by that pattern so much, to be able to catch myself more quickly as it comes up. Oh, there it comes again. And just the fact of seeing it actually then helps it fall away. So yes, absolutely. On the you mentioned like the fear of delving into that place. Somebody else said something earlier which made me think about this as well. That when we go down, if you think about it in spiral terms, when we go down to beige, we're really facing death. Now, that's the ultimate fear, the fear of death. What drives the beige value system is to stay alive. So as we descend into those places, we meet our most primal fears. And that's why we need the kind of yellow turquoise transcendent space, because it's then from that space, from our deep realization of the absolute, that we can allow that basic fear of death to transmute itself. That's where the alchemy can happen. What it does, of course, when we go there is it's like kind of spiral acupuncture. It's like we stick a pin in and then this enormous energy is released and it then surges through the rest of the spiral and then brings those other systems into alignment and makes them also more vital and everything. So I totally resonate with that. I wanted to say just a little bit on the piece about symbols, because the way it works is there's essentially different functions that you're wanting to support in the energetic architecture of a system, such as grounding, like the system maybe needs more grounding, or it needs its stressed and blocked energy to be cleared out more, or it needs more self-organizing capacity. Or it needs a more life energy, more orgone, as we would say. And different symbols they've discovered over the years have different functions. So, you know, there's the tzadeh, which is an old Hebrewic symbol, you know, helps with grounding, for example. Or there's different colors if you use colors on the map or on the organizational form, that has a certain effect. So one of the things they've learned to discern over the years is what kind of symbols, like a mandala with color or without color, different symbols have a different effect on the energetic system of any field. So that's just been trial and error over the years. But absolutely, you know, symbols, form, colors, like things like Bach flower remedies, you know, we use as well. They have anything which has everything it has resonance. They have a certain resonance, and that resonance interacts with the field of the system that you're working with and helps it to heal itself, basically. So symbols, art. Sometimes we use crop circles, formations that have come out of crop circles when balancing things. If the system asks for it, we always ask the system which particular symbol or form is best going to help it do what needs to be done at that time. So yeah, very powerful symbols, colors, sounds, all frequency, vibration, everything's ultimately, that's what everything is, you know, frequency, vibration, resonance, the word.
The word, okay. I'm struck by the kind of everything is connected implications of what you're just talking about, and one of the things that I know I feel challenged by in looking at action and implementation and movement is whether we're talking about the spiraling dynamic within my marriage, or we're talking about community systems or larger systems, is trying to sort out where the leverage points are, where the energy shift is that's going to make a particular difference at a particular point of time. And I don't expect you to kind of give us a two-minute summary of how to go about and do that, but, you know, it is the challenge, isn't it? Because if everything is connected, everything is relevant, and how do we light up those aspects that are going to be most crucial in addressing the situation at this point in time? And I think that's a lot of what your work has been about and is about, and one of the things that I deeply appreciate about what you bring. If you want to respond to that, you can, but I'm happy to go on to the next question if you are.
I can do that in less than 2 minutes, Russ.
Oh, good.
Ask the question. Get, first of all, quiet in your mind. Ask the question and notice what shows up. That's it.
That requires such self-confidence. And faith.
Basic trust in the interconnectedness of all things.
Yep. Okay, well, given that, I'll try and keep that in mind, and let's go on to Susan. She has.
Well, keep it out of mind. Keep it out of mind. God.
Keep it out. Yes. Good. Thank you. Nice correction, Susan.
Russ, I didn't have another question.
Oh, I'm sorry. I saw the one next to your name. I thought you did. Well, we got another one down here. Jennifer, do you have another question?
No, I didn't. Must be looking at the history there.
I thought I'd gotten all those. Well, then I'm going to ask Reiner in Europe if perhaps he has a question that he'd like to bring up at this point. Reiner, can you hear us?
Yes, I hear you. But I didn't push the button, but Yeah. One question, Peter. You were talking about, let's see, I have so much notes. You have been talking about a thing when to my mind came, is this the same as in the 60s, 70s, there had been this movement of,
I can speak German, so...
Positive thinking. Positive thinking. And some people I met, I had the impression they are proposing wishful thinking. And you connected it to the clear intention of action. And if the intention is only to make money, and I have the impression that a lot of people who were promoting positive thinking did this on behalf making money. So, and what's the clear difference between those and this being clear about your intention for setting the right action to help our planetary body to keep healthy or get healthy again?
Yeah, thanks, Rainer. Great question. A lot of different things related to that. I mean, essentially, in your specific answer to your question of what's the difference, it's consciousness. So, if we're doing it for money, then there's obviously a certain value system at play there. If we're doing it around the question of how can I best be of service to the world at this time, then that's a different value system that's being activated, obviously more world-centric. But the whole, it's worth spending a moment on this, on the whole kind of positive thinking intention affirmation thing, because working with affirmations is a key part of the energetic work. You know, having a, in fact, I worked this morning with a group of diverse international group of people from, hosted by Oxfam and an American organization called Rights and Resources Initiative, working on forestry and climate change and food security. And I did a whole visioning process with them and backcasting, where you put yourself in 2020, for example, and then back at what happened. And there is great power to, like, throwing an anchor out into the future. And really not just like having an affirmation in words, but really feeling in your body what it would be like for things to be that way. And then the gratitude that it is that way, as you imagine it to be, and then the release and letting it go. And that's really key, that last piece, letting go, because otherwise you're kind of attached to something out there and you're not present to how the cosmos is actually bringing things into your path that are going to help you to get to the place you just uploaded. So a lot of people have picked up like the secret stuff, you know, picked up affirmations and intention and things. I think, if I just kind of do that, then it'll all sort itself out. Well, no, there's doing that, and there's then presencing yourself again to life that starts to organize itself around you in alignment with the intention or affirmation that you have, and then you responding and taking action. Often that bit's kind of forgotten by our armchair affirmation experts. So it is a key. I mean, absolutely, in my experience, the power of holding a possibility out there, it does affect your ability to be able to manifest that. There's no doubt. It's just my experience. We have to do something on the ground as well. You know, we have to kind of respond, and we have to be paying attention to stuff that crosses our path. We have to take action. It's not just a kind of spiritual trip, as it were. Something I was going to say around that, which I can't recall right now, but
Maybe I could stimulate it for you.
Give it a try.
Okay. I'm going to go back to the idea of doing it for the world or to make money. And it would seem to me that one of the things that that getting at is that it isn't an either or. The intent, why do you want to make money, may be a critical factor. But being in good health, in good relationship, in good harmony, being in good stead requires resources, and being able to attract the resources into your life may be a critical factor in your ability to invest in your energy, to invest your energy and your livelihood and your intelligences of whatever ilk they may be in creating a context or contributing to a context that is healthier, that is making the spiral healthier.
Yeah. I think you did trigger something, actually, Russ. I think basically, as far as I understand, the way it works, the story I tell myself as I look at the physics and everything else is with an intention or an affirmation or what you're doing or any actually inner movement in yourself is you're sending out a wave, a certain frequency or resonance wave, and then that comes into interaction with other waves and frequencies. And if, you know, at some point, if you keep holding that, it like draws in other waves, acts as an attractor to other energy frequencies. And at some point, that wave becomes what they would call a standing wave, where it kind of, those different waves click in. And it's like the energy kind of gradually becomes denser. So where it may be quite subtle, and the probability, as they would talk about in quantum physics, the probability of that happening is quite low. That's all we're doing, by the way. You know, when we do this kind of work, we're working on the probability of something manifesting. There's no guarantee. But as we increase that probability, the energy waves are becoming more coherent until at some point they reach a certain level of density. And then I guess it's probably a tipping point where that subtle energetic density then clicks into material form. You know, everything's energy. I mean, if you look at the table you're sitting behind or whatever under a microscope, it's all moving, really. It's all particles running around, but it's just a certain density of energy. So what we're doing as we upload intentions or work with affirmations is essentially trying to densify the energy until it's come into a certain level of coherence that it can reach a tipping point and come into material form. That's kind of how I make sense of it myself, anyway.
Yeah, the presencing and the probabilities are so critical to that process of sense and act that you referred to earlier. So another question, this one from Philip, and it probably is going to be our last question, but let's see what is going on for Philip. Hey, Philip.
Hi, how are you, Russ? I'm finding your talk very exciting, and actually the thought of, I've learned about the tipping point in the societies and the and trying to change things in that at that form. But if you're thinking about the tipping point within yourself, then of course I keep thinking of the inertia that keeps fighting against that tipping point, right? But if you get enough to push it over, maybe you'd be okay. The question I had was, and since it's the last question, I thought maybe you could talk a little bit about, I noticed you were working on the State of the World Forum, the 2020 Climate Leadership Campaign, and I didn't know how that connected because, well, if you could talk a little bit about how that connects with your own thought process, which is very advanced and very holistic, how do you bring it back down into the real world, and where would they be, how are they going to sort of make this a tipping point, so to speak?
Well, I mean, just to say the 2020 Climate Leadership Campaign with the State of the World Forum has basically stopped its activities from a while ago. How long ago was it? Maybe a year ago even or so. But I got involved in that when we were really developing this multi-stakeholder collaboration work from the sense of can we really do the best we've got from all of our integral insights and ways of collaborating and stuff to bring together these different parties and enable them to self-organize in such a way that they organize around the key acupuncture points that would impact on climate change. So with Jim Garrison and crew, we headed off to Brazil and did some work there. And the funny thing was that both Jim and I and my community here, who kind of came out with me to Brazil and who we were working on it together with, actually were on a parallel track, even though we didn't realize it until we had a conversation later, which was we did this work. I have to say it was probably the best I could have done with everything I have out of that paradigm, like all the kind of different tools, methodologies, approaches and stuff combined and la 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 la. And there was a realization that it simply wasn't enough, or that it just wasn't adequate to the, literally the word adequate meaning fit to, it was simply not adequate to the challenge. And so that really triggered a lot of soul searching in us over here and
and in Jim as well. And funnily enough, when he then sent out a mail at some point, which was, you know, a pretty downbeat mail, which was basically, well, guys, we've tried this, and you know, we couldn't do the event in Washington because we didn't feel the political climate was right, etc., and we failed. He basically said, like, this approach to trying to address climate change, and basically we failed. And I went on to say, I think we need to go deeper to get more to the source. And when I had a conversation with him a couple of weeks after that, he was at the same place I was, essentially, the kind of green-yellow to yellow-turquoise shift. And that's the link back to Wisdom University that that Russ mentioned at the beginning. So Jim is also president of Wisdom University. And said, well, that seems to be where the energy is. There is this, basically, we're going to have to drop deeper into ourselves and to expand our consciousness higher to be able to do what's needed right here. He has a nice image of, one of the kind of logos of Wisdom University, the archer drawing his bow back. And it's like drawing the bow back into the ancient wisdom as far as we can pull it back, and then it will fly further until it ultimately comes round and pierces your own heart. So in Wisdom University, what we're working on is the combination of the ancient wisdom with the new science, and then the modern wisdom culture, as Paul Ray would call it, with the cultural creatives. That's essentially the story, essentially, which I've told today. That's the context of that story, that we reached a limit with that kind of approach to trying to tackle complex societal issues, and I've realized we've got to approach it from a fairly radically different, you know, it's the thing I'd always talked about in all my talks and public lectures and stuff. I was like, in a non-linear leap, you won't be able to see the next step from the place you're at. So if you try to do it from the same consciousness, we won't manage. And, you know, I was kind of tell the story the whole time. And then I was, God, so this is what it really means, that we're going to have to really shift out of the, you know, that central set in the spiral, that rational set, yang-based set, into the domains of the non-rational, and those other parts of ourselves, the intuitive, body-based intelligences that we have. So that's it. Funnily enough, that's kind of where we both ended up, and I'm now helping Jim to give shape to Wisdom University in Europe, because I have a feeling that's the work right now at the levels that I've been talking about in this call.
Well, it's always critical to learn from our failures as well as our successes, and that was for some of us who were observing, initially thought of as a kind of tragic failure that effort, and yet there have been things that have been spun out of that experience. Things that people took away and learned in Brazil as well as elsewhere that is still, I think, reverberating. I appreciate what all of you were doing in that regard. And, Peter, I'm going to publicly close with an appeal to you and the work you're doing in the Netherlands to show up more in the Integral Leadership Review. And as I have to do it, it's just part of my lifestyle. And what you have contributed, and Elaine and others, has been invaluable. And thank you so much for just an extraordinarily stimulating 2 hours. And all the mics for everybody are open, and you're free to say your thank yous and goodbye. And very much appreciate it, Peter.
Thanks, Peter. That was great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you so much. That was great.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Thank you
and
so
Philip,
much.
And Philip, you can take us out at any point.
Okay, great. Bye then.
Bye, Peter.
Bye. Bye.